Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, so when you picture the vast tree of life on Earth, where does your mind usually go? You probably think about the big players, right? Animals, plants, fungi. We pour, well, billions into sequencing them, charting their genes, celebrating how complex they are.
Right, but here's a, let's say, a reality check. If you're only looking at those three kingdoms, you're actually ignoring the vast majority, the real foundation, the bulk of eukaryotic diversity.
Okay.
We're talking about organisms that, I mean, literally drive the planet's oxygen production, manage global nutrient cycles. They hold the architectural blueprints for all complex life.
Are these the protists?
Exactly, the protists. They're incredibly diverse, mostly microscopic, unicellular eukaryotes. They are the true roots, the deep branches of the eukaryotic tree.
Yet they're the least studied group in genomics.
That sounds wrong. It is. It's the protist paradox. Ignoring their genomes means our whole picture of evolution, cell biology, even planetary health is frankly incomplete. It's heavily biased towards multicellular life.
So if we don't get how their cells work, we're missing fundamental secrets.
Absolutely. Secrets about life's complexity, its origins, everything.
So this deep dive is about figuring out why sequencing these tiny, often tricky genomes is such a huge challenge. And what the genomics community really needs to do about it. Today, we're celebrating the vital work of Alexandra Solon, or Francis, John M. Archibald, and, well, a really extensive team of co-authors. They published a comprehensive review in Trends in Genetics. It really pushes forward our understanding of where we are with protist genomics, the major roadblocks, and what needs to happen next, urgently.
Yeah, this paper isn't just a status update. It's more like a critical roadmap. It lays out why we desperately need these genomes, and it details exactly how we need to adapt our current sequencing infrastructure. Because let's be honest, it was mostly built for things with, you know, legs and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the immense and often bizarre complexity we find in protists.
Okay, let's unpack that. We need some background here.
Yeah.
The definition sounds simple, but you're saying the scope is huge. So what is a protist exactly?
Well, the definition is basically a catch-all. It's any eukaryote that is not an animal, plant, or fungus.
Ah, so it's defined by what it isn't.
Pretty much, which means it's an incredibly diverse polyphyletic group. They didn't all descend from one single common ancestor like animals did. But together, they represent the majority of eukaryotic diversity, and you find them everywhere. Deep sea vents, soil, your gut, everywhere.
And despite these key ecological roles driving those big global cycles you mentioned, generating protist genomes just lags way, way behind the animals and plants.
That's the crux of the problem. It's a self-reinforcing knowledge gap. Well, current genomic standards and methods, especially the ones favored by big initiatives like, say, the Earth Biogenome Project, they're really designed for the more standard genomes of animals and plants.
Okay.
They are fundamentally poorly suited for protists. It creates this massive bottleneck. We just can't process them effectively with the current toolkit.
That's fascinating about their evolutionary relevance, though. You said they represent the entirety of eukaryotic phylogenetic diversity.
Essentially, yes. All the other branches, animals, plants, fungi, are just twigs compared to the massive sprawling diversity within the protists. So if we want to accurately reconstruct the tree of life, understand those deep evolutionary relationships, we absolutely need their data.
And what specific insights do they offer? You mentioned the symbiosis.
Right. Protist genomics gives us a direct window into symbiosis and parasitism. We can sequence the free-living relatives of major human or livestock parasites, things like kinetoplastids, which cause sleeping sickness, or epicomplexans, like the malaria parasite. By comparing them, we see the genomic shifts, what genes are lost, what genes are gained or expanded that allow this move to parasitism. Things like losing flagella or boosting transporter genes. It happens independently over and over.
And endosymbiosis too, the origin of things like mitochondria.
Absolutely critical for that. Refining our models for how mitochondria and also blastids in algae and plants came about from one cell engulfing another. Protists are where these events happen and diversified.
Wow. Okay. But you also mentioned something maybe even more fundamental about multicellularity.
Yes. This is, I think, one of the most revolutionary insights. We used to think that the sophisticated molecular machinery for cells sticking together, communicating, differentiating, we had the stuff needed for multicellular life.
We thought that was unique to animals or plants.
Exactly, that it evolved with multicellularity.
But the protist data, tells a different story.
It really does. We've found genes encoding these very tools, adhesion molecules, signaling components in close unicellular relatives of animals and plants.
So the tools were there before the transition.
Precisely. The molecular blueprint, the hardware for complex life, seems to predate actual multicellularity. The components were ready, waiting for the right evolutionary moment. It fundamentally changes how we view that transition.
Okay, the scientific payoff is clearly enormous. So let's get into the methodology weeds. What makes sequencing a protist genome so incredibly difficult?
You can sort of break it down into three main challenges. First is just the sheer complexity and the wild variation in genome size.
Variation like how?
Well, you have some protists, especially parasites, with really small, compact genomes. Easy enough, relatively speaking. Hmm. But then you have groups like the dinoflagellates.
Oh, I've heard about those. They're huge, right?
Huge doesn't even cover it. Their genomes can reach up to 215,000 megabases.
Wait, say that again? 215,000 megabases.
Yeah.
That's what? Over 60 times the size of the human genome. That's not a genome. That's like an entire library crammed into one cell.
Exactly. That kind of size variation alone means there's no one-size-fits-all sequencing strategy. It's a massive hurdle.
Okay, huge size variation. What's number two?
Cultivation, or rather, the lack of it. Most protist species just haven't been successfully cultured in the lab. As of a few years ago, the estimate was something like 0.03% of predicted diversity was actually culturable.
0.03%. Wow.
Yeah. And many of the ones that eat other things, the heterotrophs, need really complex setups, often specific live bacteria as prey. Getting a clean, actinic culture is extremely difficult.
And the third problem, you mentioned contamination.
That's right. Especially for symbiotic species or medically relevant ones living inside hosts, your sample is almost always contaminated with host DNA or bacteria living with the protist or just stuff from the environment. Getting pure protist DNA can be nearly impossible without heroic efforts.
So, given these hurdles, low input, high contamination, weird genomes, what are the key technological advances helping us get around them?
Well, first, you need better ways to isolate the cells themselves, especially for those symbiotic ones. Techniques like high-throughput FACS, fluorescence-activated cell sorting, are really important. You can physically sort and separate individual protist cells from a mixed sample.
But then you have DNA from just one cell, or maybe a few. That's not much material.
Not at all. So you often need to amplify that tiny amount of DNA. That's where methods like MDA, multiple displacement amplification, come in. It boosts the signal, but you have to be careful it doesn't introduce too much bias.
Right, so that helps with the low input from isolated cells.
Yeah.
What about the vast majority we just can't culture at all?
That's where culture-independent approaches become absolutely essential. Two main strategies here: single-cell genomics and metagenomics.
Okay, single-cell genomics sounds straightforward enough conceptually, if technically hard. What about metagenomics?
Metagenomics means you sequence all the DNA directly from an environmental sample, water, soil, whatever. Then you try to computationally piece together genomes from that mixed soup. These are called MAGs, metagenome-assembled genomes.
But I thought metagenomics was mostly used for bacteria and archaea. Their genomes are much simpler.
Traditionally, yes. Reconstructing eukaryotic MAGs is much, much harder. Their genomes are bigger, full of repetitive DNA, complex gene structures with introns. It's a computational nightmare compared to prokaryotes.
You need special tools.
Definitely. Specialized bioinformatics pipelines, like one called UKIST, have been developed specifically to try and tease out and assemble eukaryotic genomes from these complex community data sets.
And underpinning all these approaches must be improvements in the actual sequencing tech.
Absolutely crucial. The rise of long-read sequencing technologies, think PacBio, especially their newer Revio system, or improved Oxford nanopore sequencing, has been a game changer.
Why long-read specifically?
Because only these longer reads, sometimes tens or hundreds of thousands of bases long, can span across those highly repetitive regions or cover large introns or help resolve polyploidy having multiple copies of the genome, which are all super common features that break traditional short read assemblies of protist genomes.
Okay, let's pivot to the key findings highlighted in the review. Just how bad is this genomic underrepresentation? Give us the numbers.
The numbers are pretty stark, yeah. As of early 2025, the public databases held only about 2,743 genome assemblies, and those correspond to just 11,121 distinct protist species.
Only about 1,100 species sequenced out of how many estimated?
Estimates vary wildly, but some go up to potentially 10.5 million protist species.
10 million. So we have genomes for maybe 0.01% of the predicted diversity.
Something like that. It's truly a minuscule fraction. A drop in the ocean doesn't even capture it. We are flying blind for the vast majority of eukaryotic life.
And even where we do have genomes, you mentioned a taxonomic bias.
A massive bias. We tend to sequence what impacts us directly. So the available data is heavily concentrated in a few specific groups, mainly the SARS supergroup, that's stromatophiles, alveolates, and rhizarians, and another group called discobids.
And within those groups?
It's skewed heavily towards species that cause diseases in crops, like Phytophthora blight, or in humans and livestock. Think Plasmodium, the malaria parasite, or Leishmania. We're sequencing the pathogens.
But neglecting their free-living relatives.
Yeah.
The ones that might hold the evolutionary context.
Exactly. We're missing the baseline diversity that could tell us how these pathogens evolved and what makes the vast majority of protists ecologically successful without causing disease.
And on top of the bias, the quality of the genomes we do have often isn't great.
That's another major finding. Most existing protist genomes are highly fragmented. They're assembled only to the level of contigs, or scaffolds, basically. Lots of separate pieces. Very few achieve chromosome-level resolution.
How do we measure that quality objectively?
A common metric is BUSCO benchmarking universal single-copy orthologs. It checks for the presence and completeness of a set of core genes expected to be found in that group. For protists, the review notes that less than 3% of the available assemblies achieve greater than 90% BUSCO completeness.
Less than 3% reach that quality benchmark.
Right. So mostly, the field is working with blurry, incomplete genetic snapshots.
But even with these fragmented views, protists are revealing some truly unique and complex genomic features, right? Things that challenge our standard molecular biology textbooks.
Oh, absolutely. This is where it gets really fascinating from a biological innovation standpoint. Take the ciliates, for example. They have this thing called nuclear dualism.
Dual nuclei, two different kinds.
Exactly. They have a small diploid micronucleus, that's the protected germline DNA passed down through generations. And then they have a huge polyploid macronucleus, that's the workhorse nucleus, handling all the day-to-day gene expression.
Okay, that's already unusual.
But how they manage these two is even wilder. During sexual reproduction, the new macronucleus is generated from the micronucleus, but it goes through this massive editing process. It actively eliminates thousands of specific DNA sequences called IESs, internally eliminated sequences.
Mm.
Most of this is non-coding DNA, but it's like the cell is manually curating and purging its own functional genome every generation. It's large-scale programmed genome rearrangement.
Wow, okay. And then you mentioned kinetoplastids earlier.
Right, those parasites. They have a kinetoplast, which is this massive condensed network of mitochondrial DNA inside their single mitochondrion. And their mitochondrial genes undergo extensive RNA editing.
Editing the RNA after it's transcribed.
Yes, specifically inserting and deleting dozens, sometimes hundreds, of uridine nucleotides. It's essential to create functional messenger RNAs. Again, a major deviation from the standard eukaryotic rules.
And the list keeps growing. Things like non-standard genetic codes.
Expanding fast. And totally unexpected discoveries keep happening, like the recent finding of nitroplasts in a marine alga.
Nitroplasts. Like chloroplasts, but for nitrogen fixation.
Essentially, yes. Yeah. An organelle apparently derived from a symbiotic bacterium that allows the eukaryotic cell to fix nitrogen. It's a fundamentally new type of organelle, a capability we thought was exclusive to prokaryotes.
It really feels like an untapped reservoir of biological mechanisms.
It absolutely is. The key point is that biological complexity isn't just a feature of multicellular life. Protists are masters of cellular and genomic innovation.
Okay, so this leads us directly into the critical discussion in the review. Challenging the established standards. If the current way of doing things is holding back discovery, how does the approach, maybe even policy, need to shift?
This is probably the most crucial call to action in the paper. The authors argue very strongly that these plant and animal-centric standards are actively hindering progress in protist genomics. The current, very strict definition of what constitutes a reference genome, the kind demanded by big projects like the Earth Biogenome Project, is simply too rigid, too restrictive for this incredibly diverse domain of life.
You mentioned that self-reinforcing problem earlier. Bad references mean new data is hard to annotate, which keeps the references bad. Can you elaborate on that loop?
Exactly. If you sequence a new protist, you need existing reference genomes to help assemble it, annotate its genes, understand its function. But if the reference databases for related protists are sparse or fragmented,
your new data is harder to make sense of and probably won't meet those high reference standards itself.
Right. It gets stuck. You can't easily publish it as a high-quality genome, so it doesn't significantly improve the reference database for the next person. It's a vicious cycle.
So how do we break that cycle? The paper suggests something counterintuitive.
Yes. To break it, the authors advocate for a radical shift in data sharing and publication norms. The community needs to start actively promoting and, importantly, publishing genome and transcriptome assemblies that are fragmented and incomplete.
Publishing complete data. That goes against the whole push for platinum standard genomics, doesn't it?
It does seem counterintuitive. But the argument is we cannot wait for perfection when we desperately need context. These suboptimal datasets are essential stepping stones.
How so?
They provide enough information, even fragmented, to start refining our methods, training our annotation algorithms, building better comparative frameworks, and populating those sparse reference databases for diverse protist groups. We need to flood the system with this intermediate data, even if it's messy, to build the foundation upon which truly complete reference genomes can eventually be built. It's about enabling progress, not just setting an impossible bar.
Okay, so a policy shift towards accepting intermediate data. What about specific technological needs to get better data, especially aiming for chromosome-level assemblies from these difficult samples?
A big one is developing and adapting low-input protocols for chromatin conformation capture techniques. The most common is Hi-C.
Hi-C helps link DNA fragments that are physically close in the nucleus, right? Even if they're far apart on the linear sequence.
Exactly. It provides long-range scaffolding information. Adapting Hi-C to work reliably with the tiny amounts of DNA you get from a few sorted cells or even a single cell would be a huge step towards turning those fragmented scaffolds into near chromosome level assemblies.
In dealing with that unique contamination problem.
Yes, we desperately need better, smarter decontamination tools. Not just generic filters, but tools specifically designed for protist genomics. They need to be able to distinguish protist DNA from, say, ingested bacterial prey DNA, or the DNA of an endosymbiont living inside the protist, or even horizontally transferred genes. It's a complex signal separation problem. Current tools often can't cope well.
And finally, coming back to that quality metric, BSCO.
Right. We need to significantly expand and refine the taxon-specific USGO gene sets for protists. Right now, the sets are based on the limited biased genomes we already have. This makes it hard to accurately assess the completeness of a new genome from a poorly represented group. Better BSCO sets, tailored to the specific evolutionary branch, are needed for reliable quality assessment, which again feeds back into getting more data accepted and utilized. We need to know what complete actually means for a dinoflagellate, not just compare it to a mammal or a yeast.
This whole deep dive really underscores that protist genomics isn't some niche corner of biology. It feels like the genuine frontier. It offers fundamental insights into the origin of life, how multicellularity arose, the nature of symbiosis, things you just can't find easily elsewhere.
That's the core message, absolutely. Achieving high-quality protist genomes is essential, but it demands that we move beyond our traditional, often conservative, animal and plant-focused standards. We have to fully embrace single-cell and metagenomic approaches. And crucially, we need to recognize the inherent value of incomplete data as a necessary, vital stepping stone towards eventually building truly comprehensive reference assemblies for the vast, unexplored majority of eukaryotic life on Earth.
So what does this needed shift in approach really mean for how we tackle genome sequencing globally? And maybe more excitingly, what complete novel molecular features, maybe things even stranger than nitroplasts or nuclear dualism, are we currently missing? Just because we haven't sequenced the right unassuming protist living in a puddle somewhere? That's the question we'll leave you with.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CCB Y4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.